your things? The house looked the same, though the heavy foyer furniture now wore its green chintz slipcovers. In his study, the pile of manuscript, the pile of notes, the array of reference books were all in the same places. His writing board lay on the desk, with the yellow pages of his day's work clipped to it, awaiting morning revision.
"Why, Aaron, you haven't even begun to pack."
"We'll talk about it over tea," he said with an embarrassed smile. "I suppose you'd like to have a wash first."
"But what's the situation, Uncle Aaron? Haven't you heard from Rome? Didn't word come from Washington?"
"Word came from Washington. That was fine of Leslie." He sank into a chair. "I really can't stand on this ankle yet for more than a few minutes. I stupidly fell again when it was almost healed. What a nuisance I am. But anyway, I reached page 967 today, and I do think it's goodish. Now go and have a wash, Natalie. You look positively boiled, and you're caked with dust."
The young consul in Florence received her affably, rising from behind a heavy, carved black desk to escort her to a chair. The room reeked of the rum-flavored tobacco he was smoking in a curved, rough briar pipe. The Sherlock Holmes prop looked odd in his small hand. He had a pink-and-white face, gentle, bright blue eyes, and a childish, thin mouth with the lower lip pulled in, as though at some permanent grievance. His blonde hair was thick, short, and straight. His gray silk suit, pinned white collar, and blue tie were elegant and neat. His desk nameplate read, "August Van Winneker, the Second." He said, in a quavering voice, clearing it of hoarseness as he talked,
"Well, the eminent author's niece, huh? What a pleasure. I'm sorry I couldn't see you this morning, but I was just up to my ears."
"Perfectly all right," Natalie said.
He waved his little hand loosely.
"People have been scurrying home in droves, you see, and just dumping everything on the consulate. There's an awful lot of commerce still going on, and I'm stuck with the paperwork. I'm becoming a sort of broker and business agent for any number of American companies. Unpaid, of course. I was in the most unbelievable snarl this morning over, of all things, a truckload of insecticide. Can you bear it? And, of course, there still are Americans in Florence. The screwier they are, the longer they stay."
He giggled and rubbed his back hair.
"The trouble I've been having with these two girls, roommates from California. I can't mention names, but one of them is from a rich Pasadena oil family. Well, she's gotten herself engaged to this slick little Florentine sheik, who calls himself an actor, but actually is nothing but an overgrown grocery boy. Well, this oily charmer has gone and gotten her roommate pregnant, my dear. The three of them have been having all-night brawls. The police have been in and..." "Oh, well, you don't get rich in this work, but there's never a dull moment."
He poured water from a tall bottle into a heavy, cut-glass goblet and drank.
"Excuse me, would you like some Evian water?"
"No, thank you. I have to drink an awful lot of it. Some stupid kidney thing. Somehow it gets worse in the spring. I actually think Italian weather leaves a lot to be desired, don't you? Well,"
his inquiring, bland look seemed to add,
"what can I do for you?"
Natalie told him about the new wrinkle in Jastrow's situation. The day Italy had entered the war, a man from the Italian security police had visited Jastrow and warned him that, as a stateless person of Polish origin, he was confined to Siena until further notice. She mentioned, as cordially as she could, that the OVRA undoubtedly knew this fact from intercepting Van Winneker's letter.
"Oh, my God, how perfectly awful!" gasped the consul. "Is that what's happened? Oh, you're quite right. I didn't have my thinking cap on when I wrote that letter. Frankly, Natalie, if I may call you that, I was floored when your name came in today. I figured you'd have come and gone by now and taken your troublesome uncle home. He has been a trial, you know. Well, this is a pretty kettle of fish. I thought the visa solved everything and that I'd seen the last of the Jastrow case.
What do we do now? Natalie said.
I'm blessed if I know. Just offhand, said Van Winneker, running his fingers through his hair upward from the back of his neck.
May I make a suggestion? Natalie spoke softly and sweetly.
Just renew his passport, Mr. Van Winneker. That would stop the statelessness business. They couldn't hold him back then.
Van Winneker drank more Evian water.
Oh, Natalie, that's so easy to say. People don't see the screaming directives we get, warning us against abuse of the passport system. People don't see departmental circulars about consuls who've been recalled and whose careers have gone poof because they were loose about these things. Congress makes the immigration laws, Natalie. The consular service doesn't. We're simply sworn to uphold them.
Mr. Van Winneker, the Secretary of State himself wants Aaron cleared. You know that.
Let's get one thing straight.
Van Winneker held up a stiff finger, his round blue eyes gone sober. He puffed his pipe and waved it at her.
I've had no instructions from the Secretary. I'm extremely glad we're doing this face-to-face, Natalie, instead of on paper. He couldn't go on record as intervening for one individual against another in matters involving equal treatment under law.
The eyes relaxed in a sly twinkle.
I did hear from Rome, between you and me, that his office asked us to expedite your uncle's departure. I was stretching way over backwards, honestly, issuing that visa, jumping him to the head of a list of hundreds and hundreds of names.
Van Winneker knocked his pipe into a thick copper tray and went on in a different, gossipy tone.
Actually, I think time will solve your uncle's problem. The French are already asking for an armistice. The British won't fight on very long. They'd be mad to try. If they do, the Luftwaffe will pound them to a jelly in short order. No, I fear me, this round goes to Fritz. No doubt they'll have another go 20 years hence, when I devoutly hope to be out to pasture.
But we can't count on the war ending, Natalie expostulated.
Oh, I think you can. I expect peace by July 1st, if not sooner, Natalie. Then these wartime exit regulations will lapse and your uncle can just pick up and go home. Actually, this gives him the leisure to sort and crate his books. He seemed so concerned about his books.
I want to take Uncle Aaron home tomorrow, and abandon books and everything. Please, give him the passport.
My dear, the contradiction in dates is right there in your uncle's expired book. It's incredible how those things used to slip through, but I've seen 100 such cases if I've seen one. People used to be mighty careless. Now that it's been detected and made a matter of record, he has no more claim to American citizenship, technically speaking, than Hitler does. I couldn't be sorrier, but it's my duty to tell you the law.
This man was getting on Natalie's nerves. The use of Hitler's name disgusted her.
It strikes me that your duty is to help us, and that you're really not doing it.
He opened his eyes very wide, blinked, drank more Evian, and slowly stuffed his pipe, staring at the tobacco.
I have a suggestion. It's off the record, but I think it'll work.
Tell me, by all means. He pushed his hair straight up.
Just go.
She stared at him.
I mean that. He's got his visa. You've got your passport. Hop a bus or train, or hire a car, and scoot to Naples. Ignore the confinement to Siena. The Italians are so sloppy. Get on the first boat and just leave. You won't be stopped. Nobody's watching your uncle.
But won't they ask for an exit permit? "'It's a trivial formality, dear. Say you lost it. Fumbling for it, you happen to take out a few thousand lira and put it on the table.' He blinked humorously. "'Customs of the country, you know.' Natalie felt her self-control giving way. Now the man was advising them to bribe an official, to risk arrest and imprisonment in a fascist country. Her voice rose to shrillness. "'I think I'd rather go to Rome and tell the consul-general that you're thwarting the desire of the Secretary of State.' The consul drew himself up, smoothed his hair with both hands, put them on the table, and said slowly and primly, "'That is certainly your privilege. I'm prepared to take the consequences of that, but not of breaking the law. As it happens, I'm exceptionally busy. Several other people are waiting, so—' Natalie understood now how her uncle had fallen foul of this man. With a quick change to a placating smile, she said, "'I'm sorry. I've been traveling for 2 straight weeks. I've just lost my father, and I'm not in the best of shape. My uncle's disabled, and I'm very troubled about him.' At once the consul responded to the new manner. "'I entirely understand, Natalie. Tell you what, I'll comb his file again. Maybe I'll come up with something. Believe me, I'd like nothing better than to see him go. You will try to find a way to give him a passport? Or to get him out. That's all you want, isn't it? Yes. I'll give it my serious attention. That's a promise. Come back in a week.' Chapter 30 Eagle and Sea Lion From World Empire Lost The False Legend The British have always been brilliant at war propaganda. Their portrayal of the so-called Battle of Britain was their supreme triumph of words. For uninformed people, their propaganda has hardened into history. A serious military discussion has to start by clearing away the fairy tales. After the fall of France, Germany was incomparably stronger than England on the ground, about equally matched in the air, and gravely inferior at sea. Our surface navy was weak and meager. Only the U-boat arm had real weight. The whole problem in the summer of 1940 was to force a decision across a sea barrier. In a set-piece invasion campaign, therefore, the British held the crucial advantage. I have already stated, in my outline of Case Yellow, my belief that had we improvised a surprise crossing in June, when the disarmed British land forces were reeling home from Dunkirk and their fleet was on far-flung stations, we might have conquered England in a short, fierce campaign. But Hitler had passed up that chance. The resilient English had caught their breaths, instituted drastic anti-invasion measures, and marshaled their powerful navy to block a channel crossing. At that point, Germany could only attack in the air, either to force a decision or to blast a path for invasion. At the start, one must compare the opposed air forces. 99 out of 100 people, including Germans, still believe that a vast and powerful Luftwaffe was defeated by a valorous handful of Thermopylae defenders in RAF uniforms. Or, in the words of the great phrase-maker, "Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few." In fact, both Germany and England had about 1,000 fighter planes when the contest began. Germany's bomber command was larger than England's, but the English bombers, at least the newer ones, were heavier, longer-ranged, and more powerfully armed. Hitler and Goering, of course, voiced the most extravagant boasts about the Luftwaffe to induce the British to make peace. Churchill, on the other hand, played up the fact that England was outnumbered and alone, so as to pull the United States into the war. As a result, the contest took on a false aspect of David against Goliath. British advantages. Not only is the conventional picture distorted on the comparison of forces, it takes no account of the handicaps under which the Luftwaffe operated. Most of the battle was fought over the British air bases. Every German pilot shot down over land was lost, either dead or a prisoner. But a downed British pilot, if he were unharmed, could soon take another plane into the skies. The German pilot had only a few minutes of flying time in which to do battle, for our fighters had a fuel limit of 90 minutes or so, most of which was consumed simply in getting to the scene and returning to base. The British pilot, as soon as he had climbed to combat altitude, could fight until he ran out of bullets or gas. Because of our fighter plane's short range, we could reach only the southeast corner of England. The Luftwaffe was like a tethered falcon, with London at the far end of the tether. The rest of the United Kingdom was fairly safe from air attack, because unescorted bombers ran a high risk of annihilation. The Royal Air Force could retire beyond range at will for rest and repair, and far beyond the firing line could keep fresh reserves and could rush the building of new planes. Our fighters were further handicapped by orders to fly in close formation with the bombers, like destroyers screening battleships. No doubt this gave the bomber pilots a sense of security, but it hobbled the fighters. In air combat, seek out and destroy is the rule of rules. Fighter pilot teams should be free to roam the airspace, spot the enemy, and strike first. Goering could never grasp this elementary point, though his fighter aces kept urging it on him. As our bomber losses climbed, he insisted more and more violently that the fighters should nursemaid the bombers, almost wingtip to wingtip. This seriously depressed pilot morale, already strained by prolonged combat and the death of many comrades. Finally, the British in 1940 had one lucky scientific edge. They were first in the field with battle-worthy radar and the fighter control it made possible. They could follow our incoming flights and speed their fighters straight at us. No fuel was wasted in patrol, nor were forces dispersed in search. If not for this factor alone, the Luftwaffe Fighter Command might have won a quick knockout victory. For in the end, the Luftwaffe did all but shoot the Royal Air Force out of the skies. Churchill himself, and he is not interested in praising the German effort, states that in September, the battle tilted against his fighter command. Our attack at that point shifted to strategic bombing of London. Churchill asserts that it was Goering's fatal mistake. In truth, given the onset of bad weather, the provocative terror bombing of our cities, which required stern immediate retaliation, and the fact that invasion had to be tried before October 1st, or not at all, the shift was almost mandatory. I discuss this point in detail in my day-by-day analysis of the campaign. The purpose of Eagle attack. Adler Angriff, the Luftwaffe's Eagle attack on England in the summer of 1940, was essentially a peacemaking gesture. It was a limited effort intended to convince the British that to prolong the war would serve no purpose. The effort had to be made before the attack on Russia to protect our rear to the westward. That it failed was, of course, a tragedy for Germany, since we were condemned to carry on this climactic world battle on two fronts. Historians are curiously slow to realize that it was more tragic for England. Germany, after all, entered the war with little to lose. But in 1939, England was the world's first power. As a result of the war, though a supposed victor, she lost her world-girdling empire and shrank to the size of her home islands. Had the Adler Angriff induced her to make peace with Germany in 1940, that empire would almost surely still be hers. So it is hard to understand why the so-called Battle of Britain was her finest hour. Her pilots performed with dash and valor, like their German racial cousins, but England threw away her last chance to prolong her world role, linked to a vigorous rising continental power. After that, she allied herself with Bolshevism to crush that power, Europe's last bastion against barbaric Asia. And she became, as a result, a weak, withered satellite of the United States. This debacle was all the work of the visionary adventurer Churchill, to whom the people had never before given supreme office. Churchill cast himself in the role of St. George, saving the world from the horrible German dragon. He had the pen and the tongue to push this legend. He himself always believed it. The English believed it, long enough to lose their empire, before becoming disillusioned and voting him out. Hitler and England. Of all things, Hitler wanted no war with England. To this I can personally testify. I do not need to, for it is written plainly in his turgid and propagandistic self-revelation, Mein Kampf. I saw his face at a staff conference on the day that England gave its strategically insane guarantee to Poland. I saw it again by chance in a corridor of the Chancellery on September 3rd, when, contrary to Ribbentrop's assurances, England marched. That time, it was the face of a shattered man. It is impossible to understand what happened in 1940 without having this fact about Adolf Hitler firmly in mind. For from the start of the war to the end, German strategy, German tactics, and German foreign policy were never anything but this man's personal will. No world historical figure, when entering the scene, ever made his aims and his program clearer. By comparison, Alexander, Charles XII, and Napoleon were improvisers, moving where chance took them. In Mein Kampf, Hitler wrote in bombastic street agitator language what he intended to do upon attaining power. And in the 12 years of his reign, he did it. He wrote that the heart of German policy was to seize territory from Russia. That effort was the fulcrum of the Second World War, the sole goal of German arms. He also wrote that before this could be attempted, our traditional enemy, France, would have to be knocked out. In discussing England, Hitler, in Mein Kampf, praises the valor of the race, its historical acumen, and its excellent imperial administration. Germany's grand aim, he says, must be a Nordic racial alliance in which England maintains its sea empire, while Germany, as its equal partner, takes first place on the continent and acquires new soil in the East. From this conception, Hitler never departed. When Churchill spurned his many peace offers, he felt a frustrated fury, which he vented on the Jews of Europe, since he felt that British Jewry was influencing Churchill's irrational policy. Almost to the hour of his suicide, Hitler hoped that England would see the light and would come to the only sensible arrangement of the world that was possible, short of abandoning one half to Bolshevism and the other half to the dollar-obsessed Americans, the outcome the world must now live with. In these considerations lies the secret of the failure of Adler Angriff, of our arrival at the coast, facing panicky England, without an operational plan for ending the war, and of the persistently unreal air about the Sea Lion plan, which, after elaborate and costly preparations, never came off. In the last analysis, the set-piece invasion did not sail because Hitler had no heart for beating England, and somehow our armed forces sensed this. The Air Battle. The battle went in several stages. The Luftwaffe first attempted to make the British fight over the Channel by attacking shipping. When the RAF would not come out and fight for the ships, Goering bombed the fighter bases. This forced the British fighter planes into the air. After knocking them about pretty badly, Goering, pushed by Hitler because of unconscionable British bombing of our civilians, sent in his bombers in the great Valhalla waves against London and other major cities, hoping to cause the people to depose Churchill and make peace. Hitler's July 19th speech, though perhaps a little blustery in language, had set forth very generous terms. But all was in vain, and the October rains and fogs closed gray curtains on the weary stalemate in the air. So ended the Battle of Britain, with honors even, and England badly battered but gallantly hanging on. Most military writers still blame Goering for our defeat over England, but this falls into the trap of the Churchillian legend that the Luftwaffe was beaten, that Germany's sparkling air force could do no better than fight a draw. I do, however, lay to Goering's charge. Despotic political control of an armed force, here, as in Case Yellow, again meant amateurism in the saddle. Hermann Goering was a complicated mixture of good and bad qualities. He was clever and decisive, and before he sank into stuporous luxury, he had the brutality to enforce the hardest decisions. All this was to the good. But his vanity shut his mind to reason, and his obstinacy and greed crippled aircraft design and production. Until Speer came into the picture, the Luftwaffe was worse hit by bad management and supply on the ground than by any enemy in the air, including the Royal Air Force in 1940. Goering vetoed excellent designs for heavy bombers and built a short-range air force as a ground support tool. Then, in 1940, he threw the lightly built Luftwaffe into a strategic bombing mission beyond its capabilities, which nevertheless almost succeeded. As a ground support force, the Luftwaffe shone in Poland and France and in the opening attack on the Soviet Union. It fell off as our armies got further and further away from the air bases. But for quick knockout war on land, its achievements have yet to be surpassed. In popular history, which is only Churchill's wartime rhetoric, frozen into historical error, Hitler, the raging tiger, sprang first on Poland, then insensately turned and tore France to death, then reached his blood-dripping claws toward England, and recoiled, snarling from a terrible blow between the eyes from the RAF. Maddened, blinded, balked at the water's edge, he turned from west to east, and hurled himself against Russia to his doom. In fact, from start to finish, Hitler soberly and coolly, though with self-defeating amateurish mistakes in combat situations, followed out the political goals laid down in Mein Kampf, step by step. He yearned to come to terms with England. No victorious conqueror ever tried harder to make peace. The failure to achieve this peace through the Eagle attack was, of course, a disappointment. It meant that our rear remained open to nuisance attack from England while we launched the main war in the East. It meant we had to divert precious, limited resources to U-boats. Above all, it meant the increasing intervention of America under Roosevelt. The final tragedy. These nagging results of British obduracy festered in Adolf Hitler's spirit. He had, in any case, an unreasonable attitude toward the Jewish people. But the regrettable excesses which he at last permitted trace directly to this frustration in the West. A Germany allied with England, even with a benevolently neutral England, would never have drifted into those excesses. But our nation was beleaguered, cut off from civilization, and we became locked in a mortal combat with a primitive, giant Bolshevist country. humane considerations went by the board. Behind the line, in conquered Poland and Russia, the neurotic extremists of the Nazi Party were free to give rein to their criminal tendencies. Hitler, enraged by their Churchillian opposition, was in no mood to stop them, as he could have with one word. When crossed, he was a formidable personality. This was the most important result of the Battle of Britain. Translator's Note. Rune's discussion of the Battle of Britain is unacceptable. It is not a Teutonic trait to admit defeat gracefully. I have read most of the important German military books on the war, and few of them managed to digest this bitter pill. But Rune's far-fetched thesis that Winston Churchill's stubbornness caused the murder of the European Jews may be the low point in all this literature of self-extenuation. His figures on the airplanes involved in the battle are unreliable. To be sure, few statistics of the war are harder to pin down. Depending on the date one takes as the start, the original balance of forces differs. Thereafter, the figures change week by week due to combat losses and replacements. The fog of war at the time was dense, and both commands remained with tangled records. Still, no official source I have read calls it an equal match, as Rune calmly does. His assertion that the attack was a peacemaking gesture is as ridiculous as his claim that the outcome was a draw. If there is ever another major war, I devoutly hope the United States Armed Forces will not fight such a draw. Popular history has it right. Goering tried to get daylight mastery of the air. The two fighter commands slugged it out, and he failed. Then he tried to bomb the civilian population into quitting, first by day and then by night, and failed. The British fighter pilots turned the much larger Luftwaffe back and saved the world from the Germans. The sea invasion never came off because Hitler's admirals and generals convinced him that the British would drown too many Germans on the way across, and in Churchill's words, knock on the head the rest who crawled ashore. A navy remains a handy thing to have around when the going gets rough. I hope my countrymen will remember this. There was no clear-cut moment of victory for the British. They really won when Sea Lion was called off, but this Hitler backdown was a secret. The Luftwaffe kept up heavy night raids on the cities, and this, with the U-boat sinkings, made the outlook for England darker and darker until Hitler attacked the Soviet Union. But the Luftwaffe never recovered from the Battle of Britain. This was one reason why the Germans failed to take Moscow in 1941. The Blitzkrieg ran out of blitz in Russia because it had dropped too much of it on the fields of Kent and Surrey and in the streets of London. V.H. Chapter 31. Silvery, fat barrage balloons shining in the cloudless sky ahead of the plane before land came in view gave the approach to the British Isles a carnival touch. The land looked very peaceful in the fine August weather. Automobiles and lorries crawled on narrow roads, through rolling yellow and green patchwork fields marked off by dark hedgerows. Tiny sheep were grazing. Farmers, like little animated dolls, were reaping corn. The plane passed over towns and cities clustered around gray-spired cathedrals, and again over streams, woods, moors, and intensely green, hedge-bounded fields, the pleasant England of the picture books, the paintings, and the poems. This was the end of a tedious week-long journey for Pug via Zurich, Madrid, Lisbon, and Dublin. It had begun with the arrival in Berlin of a wax-sealed envelope in the pouch from Washington. Hand addressed in red ink, top secret, Captain Victor Henry only. Inside he had found a sealed letter from the White House. Dear Pug, Vice CNO says you are a longtime booster of radar. The British are secretly reporting to us a big success in their air battle with something called RDF. How about going there now for a look, as we discussed? You'll get dispatch orders, and our friends will be expecting you. London should be interesting now, if a bit warm. Let me know if you think it's too warm for us to give them 50 destroyers. FDR. Pug had had mixed feelings about these chattily phrased instructions. Any excuse to leave Berlin was welcome. The red ink blare and boasts in the meager newspapers were becoming intolerable. So were the happy, triumphant Germans in government offices, chortling about the pleasant post-war life that would start in a month or so. So were the women strolling the tree-lined boulevards, looking slyly complacent in French silks and cosmetics. Pug even felt guilty eating the plunder in the improved restaurant menus, Polish hams, Danish butter, and French veal and wine. The gleeful voices of the radio announcers claiming staggering destruction of British airplanes and almost no Luftwaffe losses rasped his nerves as he sat alone in the evenings in the Grunewald mansion, looted from a vanished Jew. An order to leave all this behind was a boon. But the letter dismayed him, too. He had not walked the deck of a ship now in the line of duty for more than 4 years, and this shore-bound status appeared to be hardening. Walking home that afternoon, he passed the rusting, olive-painted Flakturm, and like nothing else, it made him realize how glad he would be to get out of Berlin. People no longer gawked at the high tower, bristling at the top with guns, as they had when the girder frame and the thick armor plates had been going up. Guesses and rumors about it had run fast and wild for weeks. Now the story was out. It was an AA platform for shooting at low-flying bombers. No high building could get in the lines of fire, for it rose far above the tallest rooftops in Berlin, a crude eyesore. So far, the few English raiders had hugged maximum altitude, but the Germans seemed to think of everything. This gigantic, drab, iron growth, towering over the playing children and elderly strollers in the pretty Tiergarten, seemed to Victor Henry to epitomize the Nazi regime. The lonely, cavernous house got on his nerves that evening, as his quiet-stepping Gestapo butler served him pork chops from Denmark at one end of the long, bare dining table. Pug decided that if he had to come back, he would take a room at the Adlon. He packed suits and uniforms, the great weariness of an attaché's existence. Morning coat, dress blues, dress whites, evening uniform, khakis, civilian street clothes, civilian dinner jacket. He wrote letters to Rhoda, Warren, and Byron, and went to sleep thinking of his wife, and thinking, too, that in London he would probably see Pamela Tudsbury. Next day, Pug's assistant attaché, a handsome commander who spoke perfect German, said he would be glad to take over his duties and appointments. He happened to be a relative of Wendell Willkie. Since the Republican convention, he had become popular with the Germans. "I guess I'll have to hang around this weekend, huh?" he said. "Too bad. I was going out to Abendru with the Wolf Stürlers. They've been awfully kind to me lately. They said Goering might be there."
"Go, by all means," said Pug. "You might pick up some dope about how the Luftwaffe's really doing. Tell your wife to take along a pair of heavy bloomers."
He enjoyed leaving the attaché staring at him, mystified and vaguely offended. And so he had departed from Berlin.
"How the devil do you keep looking so fit?" he said to Blinker Vance, the naval attaché who met him at the London airport.
After a quarter of a century, Vance still batted his eyes as he talked, just as he had at Annapolis, putting the plebe Victor Henry on report for a smudged white shoe. Vance wore a fawn-colored sports jacket of London cut and gray trousers. His face was dried and lined, but he still had the flat waist of a second-classman.
"Well, Pug, it's pretty good tennis weather. I've been getting in a couple of hours every day."
"Really? Great war you've got here."
"Oh, the war! It's going on up there, somewhere. Mostly to the south."
Vance vaguely waved a hand up at the pellucid heavens. "We do get some air raid warnings, but so far the Germans haven't dropped anything on London. You see contrails once in a while, then you know the fighters are mixing it up close by. Otherwise, you just listen to the BBC for the knockdown reports. Damn strange war. Sort of airplane numbers game."
Having just toured bombed areas in France and the Low Countries, Henry was struck by the serene, wholly undamaged look of London, the density of the auto traffic, and the cheery briskness of the well-dressed sidewalk crowds. The endless shop windows crammed with good things surprised him. Berlin, even in its infusion of loot, was by comparison a bleak military compound. Vance drove Victor Henry to a London apartment off Grosvenor Square, kept by the Navy for visiting senior officers. A dark flat on an areaway, with a kitchen full of empty beer and whiskey bottles, a dining room, a small sitting room, and three bedrooms along a hall.
"I guess you'll be a bit crowded here," Vance said, glancing around at the luggage and scattered clothes of two other occupants in the apartment.
"Be glad of the company."
Blinker grimaced, winked his eyes, and said tentatively, "Pug, I didn't know if you'd become one of those boffins."
"Boffins?"
"Scientific red-hots. That's what they call 'em here. The word is, you came for a look-see at their newest stuff, with a green light from way high up."
Victor Henry said, unstrapping his bags,
"Really?"
The attaché grinned at his taciturnity.
"You'll hear from the Limeys next. This is the end of the line for me, until I can be of service to you, one way or another."
The loud, coarse ring of a London telephone, quite different in rhythm and sound from the Berlin double buzz, startled Pug out of a nap. A slit of sunlight gleamed through drawn brown curtains.
"Captain Henry! Major General Tillett here, Office of Military History."
The voice was high, crisp, and very British.
"I'm just driving down to Portsmouth tomorrow. Possibly drop in on a chain home station. You wouldn't care to come along?"
Pug had never heard the expression, chain home.
"That'll be fine, General. Thank you."
"Oh, really? Jolly good."
Tillett sounded delighted, as though he had suggested something boring and Pug had been unexpectedly gracious.
"Suppose I pick you up at 5, and we avoid the morning traffic. You might take along a shaving kit and a shirt."
Pug heard whiskeyish laughter in the next bedroom, the boom of a man and the tinkling of a young woman. It was 6 o'clock. He turned on the radio and dressed. A mild Schubert trio ended, one he had often heard on the Berlin station, and news came on. In a calm, almost desultory voice, the broadcaster told of a massive air battle that had been raging all afternoon. The RAF had shot down more than 100 German planes and had lost 25. Half the British pilots had safely parachuted. "The fight was continuing," the announcer said. If there were any truth in this almost ludicrously understated bulletin, Pug thought, an astonishing victory was shaping up, high and invisible in the sky, while the Londoners went about their business. He found Pamela Tudsbury's number in the telephone book and called her. A different girl answered, with a charming voice that became more charming when Victor Henry identified himself. Pamela was a WAF now, she told him, working at a headquarters outside London. She gave him another number to call. He tried it, and there Pamela was.
"Captain Henry, you're here. Oh, wonderful. Well, you picked the right day to arrive, didn't you?"
"Is it really going well, Pam?"
"Haven't you heard the evening news?"
"I'm not used to believing the radio."
She gave an exhilarated laugh.
Oh, to be sure. The Berlin radio. My God, it's nice to talk to you. Well, it's all quite true. We've mauled them today. But they're still coming. I have to go back on duty in an hour. I'm just snatching a bite to eat. I heard one officer say it was the turning point of the war. By the way, if inspection tours are in order for you, you might bear in mind that I'm working at Group Operations Number 11 Fighter Group.
Will do. How's your fiancé?
Oh, Ted, fit as a flea. He's on the ground at the moment. He's had a busy day. Poor fellow, old man of the squadron, just turned 29. Look here, any chance that we can see you? Ted's squadron gets its spell off ops next week. We'll undoubtedly come down to London together. How long will you be here?
Well, next week I should still be around.
Oh, lovely. Let me have your number then, and I'll call you. I'm so glad you're here.
He went out for a walk. London wore a golden light that evening, the light of a low sun shining through clear air. He zigzagged at random down crooked streets, along elegant rows of townhouses, and through a green park where swans glided on calm water. He came to Trafalgar Square and walked on through the Whitehall government buildings and along the Thames to Westminster Bridge. Out to the middle of the bridge he strolled and stood there, looking at the untouched, famous old city stretching on both sides of the river. London's top-heavy red buses and scuttling black little taxis streamed across the bridge amid an abundant flow of private cars. Berlin's sparse traffic had been mostly government or army machines. London was a civilian city still, he thought, for all the uniforms. It had no flakturm. The British seemed to have produced their navy and their RAF from the mere table scraps of the prosperity still visibly spread here. Now these table scrap forces had to hold the line. His job was to make a guess whether they would. Also, to see whether their new electronic stuff was really advanced. Looking at this pacific and rich scene, he doubted it. He dined alone in a small restaurant, on good red roast beef, such as one could only dream of in Berlin. The apartment was dark and silent when he returned. He went to bed after listening to the news. The claimed box score for the day was now 130 German planes down, 49 British. Could it be true? The small, bald, mustached general, in perfectly tailored khakis, smoked a stubby pipe as he drove, a severe look on his foxy, much-wrinkled face. It had occurred to Victor Henry, after the phone conversation, that he might well be E.J. Tillett, the military author, whose books he greatly admired. And so he was. Tillett more or less resembled his book jacket pictures, though in those the man had looked 20 years younger. Pug was not inclined to start a conversation with this forbidding pundit. Tillett said almost nothing as he spun his little Vauxhall along highways and down back roads. By the sun, Pug saw they were moving straight south. The further south they went, the more warlike the country looked. Signposts were gone, place names painted out, and some towns seemed deserted. Great loops of barbed steel rods overarched the unmarked roads. Tillett said, pointing, "To stop glider landings," and shut up again. Victor Henry finally tired of the silence and the beautiful rolling scenery. He said,
"I guess the Germans took a bad beating yesterday."
Tillett puffed until his pipe glowed and crackled. Victor Henry thought he wasn't going to reply. Then he burst out,
"I told Hitler the range of the Messerschmitt 109 was far too short. He agreed with me and said he'd take it up with Goering, but the thing got lost in the Luftwaffe bureaucracy. It's a great mistake to think dictators are all-powerful. They're hobbled by their paper shufflers, like all politicians. More so, in a way. Everybody lies to them out of fear or sycophancy. Adolf Hitler walks in a web of flattery and phony figures. He does an amazing job, considering. He's got a nose for facts. That's his mark of genius. You've met him, of course.
Once or twice.
I had several sessions with him. He's a great admirer of mine, or so he says. His grasp is quick and deep. The gifted amateur is often like that. I said Goering was making the same mistake with his fighter planes, designing them for ground support, that the French were making with their tanks. You don't have to give a ground support machine much range, because the fuel trucks are always close at hand to fill them up. Those French tanks were superb fighting machines, and they had thousands of them. But the wretched things could only run 50-60 miles at a crack. Guderian drove 200 miles a day. Some difference. The French never could get it into their heads that tanks should mass and operate independently. God knows Fuller, de Gaulle, and I tried hard enough to explain it to them.
The car was bumping along a muddy detour, past concrete dragon's teeth and a stone wall, ringed in barbed wire, that blocked the highway. Masked workmen were raising clouds of gray dust with pneumatic hammers and drills.
"There's foolishness for you."
Tillett pointed at the tank trap with his pipe.
"Intended to halt invaders. What this rubbish actually would do is reduce the maneuverability of our reserve to zero. Happily, Brooks taken charge now. He's cleaning all this out."
Pug said, "General Alan Brook, is that?"
"Yes, our best man, a genius in the field. He managed the Dunkirk retreat. I was with his headquarters. I saw him demoralized only once. Headquarters was shifting from Armentières to Lille."
Tillett knocked out his pipe in a dashboard tray and shifted his cold gray eyes to Pug.
"The roads were crammed with refugees. Our command cars could hardly move. The Armentières lunatic asylum had been bombed. All the boobies had got out. There must have been 2,000 of them all over the road, in loose brown corduroy pajamas, moping, drooling, and giggling. They swarmed around our car and looked into the windows, dripping saliva, making silly faces, waggling their hands. Alan turned to me. 'It's a rout, Ted,' he said. 'We're lost, you know. The whole BEF's lost. We've lost the damned war.' That's when I said, 'Never mind, Alan. There are a lot more lunatics on the German side of the hill, including the boss.' Well, that made him laugh, for the first time in days. After that, he became himself again. 'A word in season,' the good book says."
"Do you think Hitler's crazy?" Henry said. Tillett chewed at his pipe, eyes on the road.
"He's a split personality. Half the time he's a reasonable, astute politician. When he's beyond his depth, he gets mystical, pompous, and silly. He informed me that the English Channel was just another river obstacle, and if he wanted to cross, why, the Luftwaffe would simply operate as artillery and the Navy as engineers. Childish. All in all, I rather like the fellow. There's an odd pathos about him. He seems sincere and lonely. Of course, there's nothing for it now but to finish him off. Hello, we almost missed that turn. Let's have a look at the airfield."
This was Pug's first look at a scene in England that resembled beaten Poland and France. Bent, blackened girders hung crazily over wrecked aircraft in the hangars. Burned-out planes stood in sooty skeletal rows on the field, where bulldozers were grinding around rubble heaps and cratered runways.
"Jerry did quite a job here," said Tillett cheerfully. "Caught us napping."
The ruined airfield lay amid grassy fields dotted with wildflowers, where herds of brown cattle grazed and lowed. Away from the burned buildings, the air smelled like a garden. Tillett said as they drove off,
"Goering's just starting to make sense, going for the airfields and plane factories. He's wasted a whole bloody month bombing harbors and pottering about after convoys. He's only got till the equinox, the damned fool. The channel's impassable after about September the 15th. His mission is mastery of the air, not blockade. Define your mission."
he snapped at Victor Henry, like a schoolmaster. "Define your mission and stick to it."
Tillet sighted Waterloo, lost for want of a few handfuls of nails and a dozen hammers, because a general forgot his mission. Marshal Ney's premature cavalry charge against Wellington's center, he said, surprised and overran the British batteries, gaining a golden chance to spike the guns. But nobody had thought of bringing along hammers and nails.
"Had they spiked those guns," said Tillet through his teeth, puffing angrily at his clenched pipe, chopping a hand on the steering wheel and getting very worked up and red-faced. "Had Marshal Ney remembered what the hell his charge was all about? Had one Frenchman among those 5,000 thought about his mission, we'd be living in a different world. With our artillery silenced, the next cavalry charge would have broken Wellington's center. We'd have had a French-dominated Europe for the next 150 years, instead of a vacuum into which the German came boiling up. We fought the Kaiser in 1914, and we're fighting Adolf right now because that ass, Ney, forgot his mission at Waterloo, if he ever knew it."
"For want of a nail, the kingdom was lost," said Pug.
"Damned right.
I don't know much about Waterloo, but I never heard that version. I just remember Blücher and his Prussians showing up at sunset and saving the day.
Wouldn't have been worth a tinker's damn if Ney had fetched along his hammers and nails. By sunset, Wellington would have been in full flight. Napoleon had routed Blücher 3 days earlier. He'd have done it again with ease."
The car went over the crest of a hill. Ahead, beyond green, empty pasture land, lay the blue channel, shining in the sun, and a hairline of French coast all along the horizon. They got out and stood amid high grass and red poppies blowing in a cool sea breeze. After an impressive silence, broken only by birdsong, Tillet said,
"Well, there we are. You're looking at Hitler's France."
Turn by turn, they scanned the coast through a telescope till it brought out of the car's trunk. Small images of houses and ships shimmered on the far shore.
"That's as close as Jerry's ever come," Tillet said. "Close enough, too."
"The Germans took all the neutral attachés on a tour of France not long ago," Pug said. "Brought us clear to the coast. The poppies are growing over there, too. We saw your chalk cliffs and the Maginot Line guns they were pointing at you. Now I'm looking down the wrong end of those guns."
Tillet said, "There, no problem. They lob a few shells over for terror, but they fall in the fields. Nobody's terrorized."
Running westward along the coast, they passed through silent, boarded-up villages, thickly tangled with barbed wire. Camouflaged pillboxes stood thick along the hills and in the towns. Pug saw a children's merry-go-round with the snouts of cannon peeking from under the platform of painted horses. Along the flat, stony beaches, jagged iron rods spiked up, festooned with wire. As waves rose and fell, queerly shaped tangles of pipe poked above the water. Pug said,
"Well, you're not exactly unprepared."
"Yes, Adolf was decent enough to give us a breather, and we've used it. Those pipes out beyond the waterline are just the old Greek fire idea. We set the sea ablaze with petroleum and fry the Germans we don't drown."
Barrage balloons came in sight over the hills to the west.
"Ah, here we are."
Tillet pulled up under a spreading old tree. "Portsmouth has two possible restaurants, but the city's taken a pasting. They may be short of crockery. I have some sandwiches and coffee in the boot."
"Perfect."
Pug trotted up and down the road, restoring circulation to his numb, heavy legs, then sat beside Tillet under the tree. They ate the lunch wordlessly. Tillet appeared to have no small talk whatever. Pug did not mind, being more or less like that himself.
"Look there," Tillet said, gesturing with the last of his sandwich.
In the blue sky, a patch of orange was flowering over the city, a barrage balloon on fire.
They're back today, after all. More coffee?
No, thanks.
Now, what's the damned fool doing hitting poor Portsmouth again? Yesterday he was going inland, where he should be.
Tillett deftly packed the lunch things and got his binoculars. The air vibrated with the distant thump of AA firing and the hum of planes.
Shall we get along down there? I imagine it's a feint. It doesn't look like much of a show.
Right.
Climbing in the car, Pug paused and scanned the sky high to the east.
Look there, General.
Tillett squinted skyward, saw nothing, and used his binoculars. His eyes widened.
Yes, that's more like it.
He passed the binoculars to Victor Henry. The binoculars resolved the gray moving dot into swarms of airplanes moving north in tight V's across the cloudless blue.
Henkels, a lot of 109s, and some 110s, Pug said. More than 100 of them.
No Stukas? They're sitting birds. Our pilots say it's hardly sporting to go after them.
I don't see any crooked wings up there, but they're pretty far off.
Care to join our observer corps, Captain Henry?
Tillett's voice to him was slightly more cordial. More barrage balloons over Portsmouth burst into flame and went writhing lazily down in black smoke. Fires were burning on the docks. White smoke trails crisscrossed the blue sky. The car passed a black plane nose down, burning in a grassy field, its markings hidden by flames. By the time they reached Portsmouth, firefighters were streaming water on the blazes, and people were out in the streets, gawking. Though buildings were smashed and burning, and rubble heaps blocked many streets, the town did not look anything like Rotterdam, or even some of the badly hit French towns.
Care to inspect the damage? You're welcome to, but it's a dreary sight. I'm thinking we might go straight on to the chain home station. Since Jerry does seem to be coming over today, you might find it interesting.
Sure thing.
They had the ferry to themselves. The old wooden boat rolled nauseatingly on the little stretch of open water to the Isle of Wight.
People forget how choppy this channel is, said Tillett,
clinging to a stanchion and raising his voice above the wind and the engine thump.
If the Germans do cross, they may arrive too seasick to fight. It's a factor.
An olive-painted military car awaited them at the landing. They drove across the bucolic island, passing one mansion after another shuttered and dead amid rolling wide lawns and shrubbery sprouting and flowering rankly. They saw no other car on their way to a cluster of iron and wooden huts around steel towers thrusting toward the sky, a grim blotch on the green holiday island. A tubby man with a scarlet face, the group captain in charge of the station, offered them tea in his little office, chatting about the raid on Portsmouth. He also mentioned, with some pride, a large sea bass which he had hauled from the surf at dawn.
"Well, shall we have a look at how things are going? There's rather a large attack been laid on today, I believe."
Victor Henry's first glimpse of British radar scopes at Ventnor, in a small stuffy room lit by one red light and foul with smoke, was a deep shock. He listened intently to the talk of the pale, slender man in gray tweed, called Dr. Cantwell, a civilian scientist, as they inspected the scopes. But the sharp green pips were news enough. The British were miles ahead of the United States. They had mastered techniques that American experts had told them were 20 years off. The RAF could measure the range and bearing of a ship down to 100 yards or less, and read the result off a scope at sight. They could do the same to a single incoming airplane, or count a horde of airplanes, and give the altitude, too. These instruments were marvels compared to the stuff that he had seen tested on the New York last year, and that the Navy had ordered in large quantities. Pug Henry had two immediate thoughts. that the United States Navy had to get hold of this equipment, and that the British were far better prepared for war than the world knew. He admired the quiet sense of drama with which General Tillett had bowled him over. That was well done. But it all hung on the fact that they had these remarkable radars. Here was a moment of confrontation between America and England, masked in a casual visit, in an offhand atmosphere, in a smoky, dim little room smelling of electric machinery, on a playground island deserted by the rich, facing the displaced Maginot Line guns. "We have nothing like this," he said. "Hmm?" said Dr. Cantwell, lighting a cigarette. "Are you sure? They're pretty far along at MIT, we understand, with this sort of thing." "I know what we've got." Pug saw on General Tillett's face, in the red light, the shadowy gleam that comes of drawing a good hand of cards, a deepening of lines, a brightening of eyes, nothing more. "How the devil do you obtain such a sharp beam? I pressed our boys on this. The answer was that it was a question of stepping down to shorter and shorter wavelengths. Beyond a certain point you can't do that, they say, and still get the power to shoot out the pulses to any distance." The scientist nodded, his eyes almost shut, his face as blank as possible. But he too, Pug thought, was a happy man. "Yes, that's the problem, isn't it?" he mumbled. "But they'll certainly get around to the answer. It's a question of tube design, circuitry and so forth. Our cavity magnetron does a pretty good job at that. We're not entirely displeased with it."
"Cavity magnetron?"
"Yes, cavity magnetron. One gets rid of the grid in a vacuum tube, you see, and one controls current flow with an external magnetic field. That allows for the more powerful pulses. It takes a bit of designing, but your people will certainly work it up in due course."
"No doubt. Got any cavity magnetrons for sale?"
Both Tillett and Dr. Cantwell burst out laughing, and even the enlisted men at their scopes turned around and smiled. The scarlet-faced group captain peered at a scope where a boyish operator was chattering into a headphone.
"Hello, looks like we have another circus heading this way. Forming up over Le Havre again. A couple of dozen, would you say, Stebbins?"
37, sir." Excitement thickened in the dark room as reports came in from several scopes. A young duty officer wearing headphones strolled from scope to scope, making notes on a clipboard, talking to the operators. To Pug Henry's eye, this was smooth expert work like the controlled tumult in a submarine conning tower during an attack run. General Tillett said,
"I take it you think rather well of our cavity magnetron."
"It's a major breakthrough, General."
"Yes. Strange, isn't it, that warfare has come down to fencing with complicated toys that only a few seedy scholars can make or understand."
"Pretty useful toys," said Pug, watching the duty officer write down the ranges and bearings that the radar operators were barking. "Exact intelligence of the enemy's location and movements, without disclosing your own."
"Well, of course. We're damned grateful for our boffins. A few Englishmen did stay awake while our politicians kicked away air parity and all the rest of our military posture. Well, now that you've had a look, would you just as soon pop back to London? I thought we might have to stay here a day or two to see action, but Jerry's been obliging. We can break our trip overnight at some decent hotel, then whip up to London. A couple of people there would like a word with you."
Outside 10 Downing Street, a single helmeted bobby paced in the morning sun, watched by a few sightseers on the opposite sidewalk. Remembering the grim arrays of SS men in front of Hitler's marble chancellery, Victor Henry smiled at this one unarmed Englishman guarding the Prime Minister's old row house. Tillett brought him in, introduced him to a male secretary in a morning coat, and left. The secretary led him up a wide stairway lined with portraits. Pug recognized Disraeli, Gladstone, and Ramsay MacDonald, and left him waiting in a broad room full of beautiful old furniture and splendid paintings. Perched on a Petty Point sofa, all alone, Pug had plenty of time to grow nervous before the secretary returned to fetch him. In a small, hot, cluttered room that smelled of old books and dead cigars, the corpulent old prime minister stood near the window, one hand on his hip, looking down at a spread of photographs on his desk. He was very short and very stooped, with graceful little hands and feet. He bulged in the middle and tapered upward and downward like Tweedledum. As he turned and went to meet Victor Henry, his walk was slow and heavy. With a word of welcome, he shook hands and motioned Pug to a seat. The secretary left. Churchill sat in his armchair, put a hand on one arm, leaned back, and contemplated the American naval captain with filmy eyes. The big, ruddy face, flecked and spotted with age, looked severe and suspicious. He puffed at the stump of his cigar and slowly rumbled,
"We're going to win, you know."
"I'm becoming convinced of that, Mr. Prime Minister," Victor Henry said, trying to control his constricted throat and bring out normal tones. Churchill put on half-moon glasses, took up a paper and glanced at it, then peered over the rims at Henry.
"Your post is naval attaché in Berlin. Your president has sent you here to have a look at our RDF, a subject in which you have special knowledge. He reposes much confidence in your judgment."
Churchill said this with a faint, sarcastic note, suggesting that he knew Pug was one more pair of eyes sent by Roosevelt to see how the British were taking the German air onslaught. Also, that he did not mind the scrutiny, a bit.
"Yes, sir. We call it radar."
"What do you think of my stuff, now that you've seen it?"
"The United States could use it."
Churchill uttered a pleased grunt.
"Really? I haven't had an opinion quite like that from an American before. Yet some of your best people here have visited Chain Home stations."
"Maybe they don't know what we've got. I do."
"Well, then, I suggest you report to your president that we simple British have somehow got hold of something he can use."
"I've done so."
"Good. Now, have a look at these."
From under the outspread pile of photographs, the Prime Minister drew several charts and passed them to the American. He dropped his gnawed stub into a shiny brass jar of sand and lit a fresh cigar, which trembled in his mouth. The colored curves and columns of the charts showed destroyer and merchant ship losses, the rate of new construction, the increase of Nazi-held European coastline, and the rising graph of U-boat sinkings. It was an alarming picture. Puffing clouds of blue and gray smoke, Churchill said that the 50 old destroyers were the only warships that he would ever ask of the president. His own new construction would fill the gap by March. It was a question of holding open the convoy lines and beating off invasion during these next 8 months. Every day danger mounted, he said, but the deal was bogging down. Roosevelt wanted to announce the lease of Caribbean naval bases on British islands as a trade for the destroyers, but Parliament would be touchy about bartering British soil for ships. Moreover, the president wanted a written guarantee that if the Nazis invaded and won, the British fleet would not yield to the Germans or scuttle itself, but would steam to American ports.
"It is a possibility that I won't discuss, let alone publicly record," Churchill growled. "The German fleet has had considerable practice in scuttling and surrendering. We have had none."
Churchill added, with a crafty grin that reminded Pug a bit of Franklin Roosevelt, that giving 50 warships to one side in a war perhaps was not a wholly friendly act toward the other side. Some of the president's advisers feared Hitler might declare war,
on the United States. That was another difficulty. "There's not much danger of that," Victor Henry said.
"No, not much hope of that," Churchill said. "I quite agree."
His eyes, under twisted brows, looked impish as a comedian's. Victor Henry felt that the Prime Minister had paid him the compliment of stating his entire war policy in one wily joke.
"Here's that bad man's invasion fleet. Landing craft department."
Churchill went on, scooping up and handing him a sheaf of photographs showing various oddly shaped boats, some viewed in clusters from the air, some photographed close on.
"A raggle-taggle. He's still scraping together. Mostly the proms they use in inland waterways. Such cockle shells will ease the task of drowning Germans, as we devoutly hope to do to the lot of them. I should like you to tell your president that now is the time to get to work on landing craft. We shall have to go back to France, and we shall need a lot of these. We have got some fairly advanced types, based on designs I made back in 1917. Look at them while you're here. We shall want a real Henry Ford effort."
Victor Henry couldn't help staring in wonder at this slumping, smoke-wreathed puddle of an old man, fiddling with the thick gold chain across his big, black-clad belly, who, with 3 or 4 combat divisions, with almost no guns or tanks left after Dunkirk, with his back to the wall before a threatened onslaught of Hitler's 120 divisions, was talking of invading Europe. Churchill stared back, his broad lower lip thrust out.
"Oh, I assure you we shall do it. Bomber Command is growing by leaps and bounds. We shall one day bomb them till the rubble jumps, and invasion will administer the coup de grace. But we shall need those landing craft."
He paused, threw his head back, and glared at Henry.
"In fact, we are prepared now to raid Berlin in force, if he dares to bomb London. Should that occur, while you're still here, and if you don't consider it foolhardy nonsense, you might go along to see how it's done."
The pugnacious look faded, the wrinkled eyes blinked comically over the spectacles, and he spoke in slow, jocular, lisping rhythms.
"Mind you, I don't suggest you return to your duty post by parachute. It would save time, but might be considered irregular by the Germans, who are sticklers for form."
Pug thought it was extremely foolhardy nonsense, but he said at once,
"I'd be honored, of course."
Well, probably out of the question, but it would be fun, wouldn't it?"
Churchill painfully pushed himself out of his chair, and Pug jumped up.
"I trust General Tillett is taking good care of you. You are to see everything here that you've a mind to, good or bad."
"He's been perfect, sir."
"Tillett is very good. His views on Gallipoli I regard as slightly unsound, since he makes me out at once a Cyrano, a jackass, and a poltroon."
He held out his hand.
"I suppose you've seen a bit of Hitler. What do you think of him?"
"Very able, unfortunately."
"He is a most wicked man. The German badly wants tradition and authority, or this black face out of the forest appears. Had we restored the Hohenzollerns in 1919, Hitler might still be a ragged tramp, muttering to himself in a squalid Vienna doss house. Now, alas, we must be at considerable trouble to destroy him. And we shall."
Churchill shook hands at the desk.
"You were in war plans, and you may be again. I recommend that you obtain all our latest stuff on landing craft. Ask Tillett."
"Yes, sir."
"We shall require great swarms of the things. Great swarms."
Churchill swept his arms wide, and Victor Henry saw, in his mind's eye, thousands of landing craft crawling toward a beach in a gray dawn.
Thank you, Mr. Prime Minister.
General Tillett was waiting in his car. They went to a room in the Admiralty where huge wall charts showed the disposition of the fleet. In the blue spaces of the Mediterranean, the Persian Gulf, and the Indian Ocean, the little colored pins looked sparse and lonesome, but the sewing around the home islands bristled thick. Pins in a thin line marked the Great Circle convoy path across the Atlantic. Tillett traced this line with his pipe.
There's the problem. We breathe through that tube. If Jerry can cut it, we've bought it. Obviously, we can use some old destroyers you've got lying around from the last war, not doing much of anything.
Yes, so the Prime Minister said. But there's a political problem, General. Either Hitler's a menace to the United States, in which case we need everything we've got, and a lot more, or he isn't. And in that case, why should we let you have part of our navy to fight him? I'm just giving you the isolationist argument.
Yes. Of course, we hope you'd think of common traditions and all that, and the advantage of keeping us alive, and the possibility that the Germans and Japanese, dominating Europe and Asia and the oceans, might prove more disagreeable over the years than we've been. Now, I'm still to show you those landing craft we've got up in Bristol and fight a command in Stanmore.
If I can, I'd also like to visit Group Operations Number 11 Fighter Group. Tillett blinked at him.
Number 11. Jolly good idea. Take a bit of arranging, but I believe we can lay it on.
Chapter 32. Victor Henry sat in the lobby of the Savoy, waiting for Pamela and her fighter pilot. Uniforms thronged past, with only a sprinkling of dinner jackets on white-headed or bald men. The young women, in colorful, thin summer finery, looked like a stream of excited, amorous angels. On the brink of being invaded by Hitler's hordes, England was the gayest place he had ever seen. This was nothing like the glum hedonism of the French in May, going down with knives and forks in their hands. Wherever the American had visited in a hard-driving week, and by now this included shipyards, navy and air bases, factories, government offices, and army maneuvers, he had noted the resolute, cheerful spirit borne out by the rise in production figures. The British were beginning to turn out tanks, planes, guns, and ships as never before. They now claimed to be making airplanes faster than the Germans were knocking them down. The problem was getting to be fighter pilots. If the figures given him were true, they had started with somewhat more than 1,000 seasoned men. Combat attrition was taking a steep toll, and to send green replacements into the skies was fruitless. They could kill no Germans, and the Germans could kill them. England had to sweat out 1940 with the fighter pilots on hand. But how fast was the Luftwaffe losing its own trained pilots? That was the key, Tillett said. And the hope was that Goering was already throwing everything in. If so, and if the British could hold on, there would come a crack in Luftwaffe performance. The signal, said Tillett, might be a shift to terror bombing of the cities.
Here we are, late as hell,
chirruped Pamela, floating up to him in a mauve silk dress. Pamela's flyer was short, swarthy, broad-nosed and rather stout, and his thick wavy black hair badly needed cutting. Except for the creased blue uniform, Flight Lieutenant Gallard looked like a young lawyer or businessman rather than an actor, though his brilliant blue eyes, sunken with fatigue, had a dramatic sparkle. Diamonds glittered in Pamela's ears. Her hair was done up in a makeshift way. Pug thought she had probably emerged from bed rather than a beauty parlor. And, fair enough, in the time and place.
The notion gave him a pang of desire to be young and in combat. Their table was waiting in the crowded grill room. They ordered drinks.
"Orange squash," said Flight Lieutenant Gallard. "Two dry martinis, one orange squash, very good, sir," purred the silver-haired waiter, with a low bow.
Gallard gave Victor Henry a fetching grin, showing perfect teeth. It made him seem more of an actor. The fingers of his left hand were beating a brisk tattoo on the starched cloth.
"That's the devil of an order, isn't it, in the Savoy?"
Pamela said to Pug.
"I'm told he used to drink like a proper sponge, but he went on orange squash the day we declared war."
Pug said,
"My son's a Navy flyer. I wish he'd go on orange squash."
"It's not a bad idea. This business up there,"
Gallard raised a thumb toward the ceiling,
"happens fast. You've got to look sharp so as to see the other fellow before he sees you. You have to react fast when you do see him, and then you have to make one quick decision after another. Things get mixed up and keep changing every second. You have to fly that plane for dear life. Now, some of the lads thrive on drink. They say it blows off their steam. I need all my steam for that work."
"There's a lot I'd like to ask you," said Victor Henry, "but probably this is your night to forget about the air war."
"Oh?"
Gallard gave Pug a long inquiring look, then glanced at Pamela.
"Not a bit. Fire away."
"How good are they?"
"The Jerrys are fine pilots and ruddy good shots. Our newspaper talk about how easy they are makes us a little sick."
"And their planes?"
"The 109's a fine machine, but the Spitfire's a good match for it. The Hurricane's quite a bit slower. Fortunately, it's much more maneuverable. Their twin-engine 110 is an inferior machine, seems to handle very stiffly. The bombers, of course, are sitting birds, if you can get at them."
"How's RAF morale?"
Gallard flipped a cigarette in his mouth and lit it with swift gestures of one hand.
"I'd say it's very high, but not the way the papers tell it. Not that dashing patriotic business. I can remember the first time I fought over England, when those dots appeared in the sky just where fighter control said they were. I had a bit of that feeling. I thought, why, damn their eyes, they're really trying it. And what the hell are they doing flying over my country? Let's shoot the bloody bastards down. But right away I became damn busy, trying not to get shot down myself. That's how it's been ever since."
He smoked in silence, his eyes wide and far away, his fingers dancing and dancing. He shifted in the chair, as though it were too hard.
"It's a job, and we're trying to do our best. It's a lot more fighting than we had over France. You can tell your son, Captain, that fear's a big factor, especially as the thing goes on and on. The main thing is learning to live with it. Some chaps simply can't. We call it LMF, lack of moral fiber. The brute fact is that as range decreases, accuracy increases. You've got to close the range. There's nothing to do about that old truth of warfare. But there's always the chap who opens up and blazes away from afar, you know, and runs out of bullets and heads for home. And there's the one who somehow always loses the bird he's after in the clouds, or who never finds the foe and aborts the mission. One soon knows who they are. Nobody blames them. After a while, they're posted out."
He fell silent again, looking down at the smoking cigarette in his clasped hands, obviously absorbed in memory. He shifted in the chair again and glanced up from Victor Henry to Pamela, who was watching his face tensely.
"Well, the long and the short of it is, it's us against the Jerrys, Captain Henry, and that's exciting. We're flying these machines that can cross all of England in half an hour. Excellent gun platforms, best in the world. We're doing what very few men can do or ever have done, or perhaps will ever do again."
He looked around at the elegant grill room full of well-dressed women and uniformed men, and said with an uncivilized grin,
the whites showing around his eyeballs. "If excelling interests you, there it is." He made the thumb gesture. "Up there." "Your orange squash, sir," said the waiter, bowing. "And just in time," said Gallard. "I'm talking too much." Pug raised his glass to Gallard.
"Thanks. Good luck and good hunting."
Gallard grinned, drank, and moved restlessly in the chair. "I was an actor of sorts, you know. Give me a cue and I rant away. What does your son fly?"
"SBD, the Douglas Dauntless," said Pug. "He's a carrier pilot."
Gallard slowly nodded, increasing the speed of his finger tattoo. "Dive bomber?"
"Yes."
"We still argue a lot about that. The Jerrys copied it from your navy. Our command will have no part of it. The pilot's in trouble, we say, in that straight, predictable path. Our chaps have got a lot of victories against the Stukas. But then again, providing they get all the way down, they do lay those bombs in just where they're supposed to go. Anyhow, my hat's off to those carrier fellows, landing on a tiny, wobbly patch at sea. I come home to broad, immovable Mother Earth, for whom I'm developing quite an affection."
"Ah, I have a rival," said Pamela.
"I'm glad she's so old and so flat." Gallard smiled at her, raising his eyebrows. "Yes, you've rather got her there, haven't you, Pam?" During the meal, he described in detail to Victor Henry the way fighter tactics were evolving on both sides. Gallard got very caught up in this, swooping both palms to show maneuvers, pouring out a rapid fire of technical language. For the first time, he seemed to relax, sitting easily in his chair.